veto threat, what the governor says about the bill to eliminate members of the city county council, the bills that didn't survive the General Assembly, and I-STEP overload and Democrats committing voter fraud. That plus our end of the session roundtable, winners and losers and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending May 3, 2013.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. The path to a successful business has unexpected twists and turns. The legal professionals at Ice Miller are dedicated to guiding businesses along the journey. Experience takes businesses to the top. Ice Miller can help them stay there. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
AT&T, connecting Hoosiers with the world for more than 130 years. Investing to build communication networks to help Indiana businesses and consumers succeed in a global economy. AT&T, rethink possible.
This week, a bill that Democrats call a power grab could become a veto target for the governor. It would eliminate at-large seats on the Indianapolis City County Council. The four at-large members of the City County Council are all Democrats, and Democrats see the effort to eliminate those seats as partisan warfare aimed at preserving Republican power. Mike Pence has heard the arguments.
Let me say we're going to study that very carefully.
The bill cleared the state Senate on Friday, and its author argued that it's good for taxpayers.
This could harm our party. It could help our party. I don't know. All I know is it's the right thing to do because it saves us money that we can use in other areas of the budget.
Even before the vote, Democrats were crying foul.
We've seen just barbaric political power grabs.
And today, the Republican House Speaker tried to distance himself from the controversial measure.
I pretty much took a hands-off approach on that particular bill.
The bill also gives the mayor new authority over the budget, and the governor says that's a good thing.
That being said, I have some concerns about the bill.
Mike Pence said it's one of just a few bills that he will consider vetoing. What will Mike Pence do with the Marion County government bill? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanes, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV State House reporter Jim Shella. Ann Delaney, is the governor tipping his hand?
Well, I think he's probably trying to have his cake and eat it, too. I mean, I'd like to think that he had the courage to stand up and say no, that this was a power grab and he wasn't going to be part of it. And if he does, I mean, I think it's a pretty good indication he's looking at other office. But it would show a lot more leadership than we've seen from him to date in this session. He ought to veto it. It is a bad bill on a whole mess of different levels. It's not just the power grab for control of the city county council. I mean, you've got constitutionally elected officials there that you're taking the ability to set their own budgets away from.
But Mike Pence says he likes that portion of the bill.
Does he? Well, maybe he ought to read the Indiana Constitution in addition to the legislation before he affixes his signature to it.
This would be an opportunity for him to show some bipartisanship. In a way that people would understand and remember.
Well, it would be memorable, no question about that. As we all know, there are three things you can do. You can veto it, you can let it become law without signing it, or you can sign it. And I think it's pure speculation as to what he's going to do. He said in your news conference that they were going to look at it closely. I think they are doing that. I think they really are weighing this thing heavily. Because they're getting some people who are calling them constantly on this bill.
You think?
Oh, yeah. And so I think they're weighing it, but it'll be interesting to see what he does on this one. I think there are parts of it that he does like, and I even like the parts about the – definitely like the parts about the budget that will allow the mayor to have more control over the budget. I think that's necessary here, as it is in most cities around Indiana. But I don't know what the governor's going to do with this bill.
Well, his chief of staff says he's asked to be fully briefed on what's behind this bill.
Yeah, and I'm not sure you
is
can.
Is that something new?
I don't think it happens with every bill.
Oh, well, that's what you can't read the tea leaves completely on this. You don't know necessarily where he'll end up on this. But the fact that he has seemingly gone out of his way in these news conferences to say that they're looking at it carefully. I mean, that, you're right. That's not what he's saying about every bill. If you were undecided, it would be easy to say we treat this bill and every other bill that comes from the General Assembly with the utmost care and attention, and everything. We weigh all the constitutionality of every bill. I mean, you could address it that way. But to say that this bill is getting sort of, I don't want to say special attention, suggests that there might be something to it. And
I think it is getting special attention.
Well, it is.
I'm told there was a meeting about it on Monday morning, and the bill hadn't even arrived in it. Tuesday morning, and the bill hadn't arrived in his office at that point.
And we talked last week about the argument that one of the backers, Senator Mike Young, had made, saying that this is money saving because it reduces these seats, and the city county council is larger ostensibly than it needs to be. And I mentioned last week, be careful what you wish for, because the Indiana legislature might not be the smallest in the nation. I checked this week, and in fact, there are 29 states with smaller legislatures, including California, which I think has a few more people than Indiana does. It has 30 fewer lawmakers, so that may not be the best argument to...
We could save Mike Young's salary. Wow.
Yeah, that's true. What do you think the governor does?
Well, I'm not going to make that prediction. I think he could make a strong case for vetoing it, and I agree with Ann's argument that if he does, it's a good thing. This is a bad bill. It's bad legislation. If it was a good idea, then they should have done the same thing they did with a similar bill in Allen County and essentially study it. But they decided to push ahead, and it was purely for political reasons. And I think they do need to be careful, because they may achieve something that has been unachievable to this point, and that is to unify Democrats in this county. If they unify Democrats in this county, then they may lose the top office.
The next Democratic mayor may have the advantages of all of this.
Well, but there are Democrats who say, go ahead and let them do this, because we should be able to win the next election, and then our mayor's going to have more power.
Yeah, I know, but it's still not the right thing to do. Those other elected officials are constitutionally, they're there, and they have a right to have their budget, and they don't have to report to the principal about that. They're accountable to the voters, and that's the way the system is supposed to work. Republicans always say they want it to work best when it works locally, except when they want something else.
Okay, is there a downside here if Mike Pence publicly wavers on this and then signs it?
No, I don't think so. I don't think this is getting as much attention as a lot of people think it's getting, especially outside of Marion County. I don't think so. I don't think this is a game changer for anybody.
The controversial bill that opponents call the ag gag was one of the deadline casualties in the General Assembly. It was withdrawn from the House floor in the middle of a debate, and the Senate author refused to go along with House changes to the bill. The so-called ag gag would make it a crime to photograph agricultural operations without permission, but opponents see it as an attempt to thwart the First Amendment.
The gag whistleblowers? Why do we always want to do something that's outrageous? This is outrageous for this time.
This bill's got the same problem as my golf game. It's not capable of being made good. The core idea is bad.
Representative Ed Delaney there, preceded by Representative Pat Bauer, Mike McDaniel. Is this evidence that the system works?
Well, first of all, that was my favorite quote of the whole session. Ed Delaney talking about its golf game. By the way, we wish him luck.
It's accurate.
Wish him luck. Oh, yours is accurate.
It's accurate.
I wish him luck in the mini marathon tomorrow. Yeah, he's running in that. But now, what was your question anyway?
Is this evidence that the system works?
I think it is evidence that the system works, because this bill, as hard as everybody tried to make it work for everybody involved, you can't. And the reason you can't, because it's a clash between trespassing and freedom of speech and a lot of other things that would make it almost impossible to make a bill that's going to be constitutional. And I think it was smart to withdraw it at the end of the day, and I think the system did work.
Senator Travis Holdman is the author of the bill, and he says he's going to bring it back next year.
Along with the transvaginal ultrasound bill that he introduced this last year,
well,
too?
Well, the governor signed that bill.
Oh, yeah,
this
of course
week.
He did.
Talk about trespassing.
Because they're worried about trespassing and all on farms, but they don't care about women's bodies. That's what it really comes down to. But it's a bad idea. There is no way to perfect that bill to make it constitutional. Even if it were to pass, we would spend tens of thousands of dollars litigating it unsuccessfully. Supreme Court has made it pretty darn clear that you have no expectation of privacy from above or from photography and the rest, and they ought to just give it up. And, it's not only about treatment of animals, it's also about food safety. And, maybe they ought to be concentrating on what's going on there that people are so worried about showing.
Another bill that died in the last hours was the bill that would require drug testing for welfare recipients, and it died when Republicans in the Senate Rules Committee voted against suspending rules so that it could be voted on. It was a big surprise. Is that another example of the system working?
Well, if your definition of the system working is to eliminate bills or ideas that might cause problems constitutionally, then yes. But that got a lot further than it probably would have otherwise if the committee system had been working earlier than you get to rules in the Senate. So, you know, it is a process, and I'm not here to criticize the process in that answer. I think it did work, to answer your question shortly. It's just sometimes you'd like to see it work sooner than later.
But sometimes it's not going to work unless you get to someplace like the Rules Committee, where, you know, if this bill had moved along through the process earlier, you wouldn't be voting to suspend rules, and so it'd be 50 or 25 people or 100 people deciding this instead of 8 or 12.
I guess that's the way it is in the civics textbooks, but, I mean, this is sort of the real-world aspects of this. And we've often, the cliche, of course, about lawmaking being the equivalent of sausage making. Well, this law would bar cameras in meat processing plants, but I doubt it would bar them in sausage production plants in the form of state government. And some of these things look unsavory. I guess the metaphor I'm trying to make, not very artfully, is that in the light of day, after this, when the dust settles, some of those things are not very attractive, and drug testing for welfare recipients is some of them. So there is a public spotlight, I guess I'm saying. There are cameras in the state house for good reason, and some of these bills, just when they get under that kind of spotlight, they don't stand up very well. And as far as the ag gag, we should say this week nationally, three states already have this. Utah was the first to actually bring prosecution this week. There was such a public uproar about the prosecution of this woman who had taken some cell phone camera, they withdrew the charges. And I think we'll see that kind of pattern, even where these laws have been enacted. I think there's not going to be much stomach for prosecuting
people. In regard
to
the welfare treatment, the states that have enacted this in the past have shown absolutely no difference in the drug use among welfare recipients and the population at large. And what you're doing there is you're penalizing the children who benefit from that.
Right.
And it's not well thought out. I mean, it's like standing up there and yelling for tougher sentences for crime without having to pay for the prisons or looking at the destruction it does. You've got to have somebody in this process that stands up and says it the way it is, as opposed to going along with whatever they think the poll is of the moment.
There was a concerted effort this session to make the committee system work, meaning that you're going to stop a lot of legislation there as opposed to letting things get to the floor. And I think there's a lot of evidence that was true this time. On the whole, this system does work and works more times than not for the people of Indiana.
Computer overloads led to interruptions in ISTEP testing on 2 days in a row this week. Schools were then instructed to cut the number of students taking ISTEP in half on any given day, and IPS avoided any test taking during late morning peak hours. Meantime, representatives of the state contractor who supplies the test are monitoring computers to prevent new interruptions, and the deadline for the test has been extended from May 10th to May 17th. The State Board of Education wants answers and may challenge the state contract with CTB McGraw-Hill, the state contractor. But State Superintendent Glenda Ritz says there are higher priorities at the moment.
So our first goal is to just get through the actual testing window and make sure that all students are taking the test. I understand the high stakes and the high stakes of accountability for the schools, as well as the high stakes for teacher evaluation and compensation tied to that. So validity of the student assessments needs to be determined first.
John Ketzenberger, who's to blame for the ISTEP troubles?
Well, we'll find out when the investigation's done, but it certainly looks like the vendor is at fault here. They knew that this was coming up. They had other states doing it. Their servers crashed, couldn't apparently handle the load of students that they had to know about. So I think that eventually they'll be held accountable, and they should be. The state should exercise every right in its contract and make sure that it gets the money back that it should and make sure it doesn't happen again.
First thing they're going to do is figure out if the results are valid. Now, boy, almost anybody, parents, teachers, administrators, can challenge this on the basis of kids being interrupted and having to take this test on a couple of days when they weren't planning to. And It's hard to counter that. Right?
I think so. I think this will be, you know, if this were in the a sports records book, this would be one with the asterisk, you know. So people will always say, oh, that was the year that X, Y, and Z happened. And even though the state has extended the test-taking window, you have, and I think rightly so, you have teachers and administrators who say, well, that's fine, but what happens to the lessons we were going to actually try to impart in the final few weeks of, maybe not much happens
well,
in the final
are,
weeks
and,
of school,
and
but,
you know what,
but
they're using,
that was their goal, certainly.
They're using computers for kids to take this test now that would be used for instruction for other kids, and it's having an effect on more than just the test taking.
Well, I do like the days, my old days, when if you had your number two pencil,
yeah,
that's the only thing you had to worry about. Not a three, not a one, but a number two pencil. Those were the good days, I guess.
Well, this is the first year that schools have been instructed to have everyone who can take the test online. Was that a mistake?
Well, apparently. I think John gave the right answer. John Ketchenberg gave the right answer. The vendor clearly wasn't prepared for the load. And how can you not be prepared when you know you're going to have this happen and are doing other states? But, look, I think that you threw out these results. I don't think you can justify counting on this because there's so much at stake now as a result of this.
Including school awards, teacher compensation.
And I believe in testing. I really do. I think you have to have it to make a comparison. But I don't know how you validate this.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think Glenda Risk had the right attitude toward this. Let's get the results and see. I mean, I don't know that taking the test over 2 days, you can argue about what else they would have learned in that other day, and that's a legitimate concern, and that certainly goes under the umbrella of the responsibility of the vendor. But I don't know that the test is necessarily invalid because it's taken over 2 days. And it is important for all kinds of different reasons. We've tacked all kinds of things to that test. And the most important thing, it seems to me, is to get it done and see if there's a lot of variation from year to year and whether or not it's valid.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question is, should the ISTEP results from this week be thrown out? Your choices are A, yes, B, no, or C. Let's take a look at them first. Last week's question was, did Mike Pence have a successful legislative session? 61% said yes, 22% said no, 17% said it was okay for a beginner. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. A former Democratic Party operative in Jennings County was sentenced to prison this week for voter fraud. Mike Marshall will go to prison for falsifying absentee ballots in 2011. He will spend at least 4 months and as many as 9 months behind bars. His sentencing comes the week after a voter fraud conviction in South Bend of former Democratic Party leader Butch Morgan. John Schwanes, Republicans are making a big deal out of this. Is it?
Yeah, I would make a big deal out of voter fraud. I mean, there are certain things, and we've talked about whether we're talking about Republicans or Democrats who have been in positions where they can affect outcomes, and we've seen instances where rules were not followed. And I think this is a grievous affront to democracy, if you want to get right down to it. If we don't believe that the results of elections at any level of government are valid, if you think we have a turnout problem now, if people get the idea that it didn't matter, you haven't.
But they're not both the same. I mean, there's no question that dealing with absentee ballots and falsifying absentee ballots does what you're talking about. The other charge was that they falsified signatures to get somebody on the ballot. That didn't determine
the
election.
That was the South Bend
situation. That's the South Bend situation.
Right.
I just hold any the voting process because of the importance it has in terms of engaging citizens and in thwarting or combating apathy is something we need to really keep people, hold them to a high standard.
Are you surprised to see him actually going to prison, though, for felony charges?
It is very unusual, but I'm glad it's happening. And I'm glad that that the price is being paid, because John is exactly right about the security and the belief of the system. But I think the Republicans need to be a little bit careful here about hooting a little too much. I mean, we've heard Chairman Holcomb talk on this program about the culture of
corruption
in the Democrat Party. I think he may be overstating a little bit here, and I think that he also opens up the Republicans to countercharges if and when anybody gets their nose a little bit out of joint, and inevitably that happens because it's a human system. So I think the chairman might want to consider dialing back the rhetoric a little bit.
Especially after Charlie White.
Well, I think the Republicans have felt like they were put upon because
the highest election official in the state, the elected Republican Secretary of State, was convicted of voter fraud. You think that?
Are Republicans a little defensive because they think that this takes place in both parties?
I don't think they're defensive. I think they want an integrity of the system, and that's, I think, what everybody wants at the end of the day. But you know, I'm surprised that. One, I'm surprised that Butch Morgan would be involved in something like this, being a high-profile leader, long-time
district chairman.
District chairman, he's been on every executive committee of every major Democrat candidate in the last couple decades or more. So I was really surprised and really kind of disheartened by the fact that this happened. But they're going to pay the price, and subsequently they're going to have to be made examples of, I think, because we have to protect the integrity of the system. And it's hard to watch that happen because those of us who believe in the system don't want this kind of thing to be out there because for the very reason stated. I think people lose confidence.
Finally, time for our end of the session General Assembly Roundtable. We begin with the big winner. Mike, who's the big winner in the 2013 legislative session?
Absolutely no question, Brian Bosma, for his leadership of the supermajority in this session. A lot of people were concerned about how he would handle that. He did it beautifully and was praised by people from all walks of life.
I don't think there is a big winner. To come close, I mean, maybe Mississippi, because now we're in competition. You know, we don't have health care, we don't have transit, we want to deprive the schools of funding, you know. We want to lower wages. Yeah, maybe Mississippi.
Big winner.
I'm going to say Vectren, actually, because in a campaign that they waged in the legislature, they were able to get a big project killed. And
the Rockport plant. Coal gasification project.
And they were the only people out there.
You know, since I wasn't thinking that initially, but since the next question, which is loser, I was thinking of Leucadia. I guess by definition, I have to agree with you that Vectren may be a winner. But I also think that the leadership of the four caucuses, and in this, it may seem counterintuitive, but in this case, the leaders of the caucuses that had supermajorities, I think, did have the tougher time than the leaders of the caucuses that basically just had to sit there and take it. And I do think Brian Bosma did a terrific job.
I vote Brian Bosma. Big loser.
Big loser. I think it's the 400,000 people who would have had health care coverage and the 30,000 jobs that would have come if we had gone in under the Affordable Care Act.
I thought we were talking about legislators, so that's what I came armed with today. It'd be easy to point to Pat Bauer for having lost his leadership spot the way he did. But actually, Pat Bauer looked like he embraced his new role and probably enjoyed himself because the weight of the world was off his shoulders. And let me echo something that John said. I think Pilaf did a nice job, really did, in a new role there.
You didn't name a loser.
Yeah, well, I started with Bauer.
Okay, loser.
I already answered it, I guess, coal gasification efforts. But also, I won't say the whole casino industry because you can't. They're not monolithic. Some wanted one thing, but there are those who were wanting more relief and didn't get it.
Yeah, I think I see your point on it, but I would say that they got what they really wanted, and that was the relief on those game tabs that they were, or the promotions that they wanted to send out.
Something's better than nothing.
Well, that's really going to be helpful. I think Leucadia, the plant, is the big loser.
I'll go with the casino industry. They didn't have a good session. Okay, Rookie of the Year in the General Assembly, Mike.
Sharon Nagel from Attica. Small businesswoman, very sharp, did a good job of coming in our first session on the Ways and Means Committee, fit right in and was a real contributor.
Author of the abortion bill.
Yeah. Representative Forrestal. When you get rookies, they tend to not speak at all or they speak on very narrow issues. He spoke out very intelligently on a number of different issues, and I think he's the Rookie of the Year.
You know, I had thought about Representative Nagel too, but I was thinking in terms of the categories, and I had actually Representative Pilaf as the Rookie of the Year. You know, in his first year in leadership, I thought he did a great job handling the session.
I agree with all of those answers, but I also was kind of thinking it in non-traditional terms, maybe Tim Brown. You had longtime leaders of Ways and Means Committee, 40 years of combined experience, disappeared, new chairman, granted not a rookie lawmaker, but a rookie in that role. Seemingly got high marks.
I say Senator Mike Crider, Republican from Greenfield.
That's a good one too.
He had a good year. All right. Lawmaker of the Year, Ann Delaney.
Oh, it's obvious. Ed Delaney.
Somehow I knew.
Well, I like Ed Clare. Ed Clare did a great job. He wasn't even on the health committee last year. He was the chairman this year. Was very thoughtful and took tough issues and made a good run.
He did a very good job.
Caucus leaders with Brian Bosma probably atop the pack.
Yeah, I pick Brian Bosma.
Yeah, I would pick Ed Clare, but he was spitting in the wind most of the time.
That's because he was interested in expanding health care, and his ideological caucus was not. But that doesn't mean he doesn't deserve credit for standing up to them.
Brian Bosma is a good choice. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwantes of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/podcast or starting Monday. You can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Thank you, Betty.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Things can go wrong in 1,000 different ways. Businesses need a law firm that knows the 1,000 and first. The team of legal professionals at Ice Miller is committed to helping put the pieces back together. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
AT&T, connecting Hoosiers with the world for more than 130 years. Investing to build communication networks to help Indiana businesses and consumers succeed in a global economy. AT&T, rethink possible.